Gospel according to St. Matthew, the 5th chapter. Jesus said, "You have heard that it was said to those of ancient times, 'You shall not murder, and whoever murders shall be liable to judgment.' But I say to you, if you are angry with a brother or sister, you will be liable to judgment. And if you insult a brother or sister, you will be liable to the council. And if you say, 'You fool,' you will be liable to the hell of fire. So when you are offering your gift at the altar, if you remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First, be reconciled to your brother or sister, and then come and offer your gift. Come to terms quickly with your accuser while you are on the way to court with him, or your accuser may hand you over to the judge, and the judge to the guard, and you will be thrown into prison. Truly, I tell you, you will never get out until you have paid the last penny. You have heard that it was said, 'You shall not commit adultery.' But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lust has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one of your members than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one of your members than for your whole body to go into hell. It was also said, 'Whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce.' But I say to you that anyone who divorces his wife, except on the ground of unchastity, causes her to commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. Again, you have heard that it was said to those of ancient times, 'You shall not swear falsely, but carry out the vows you have made to the Lord.' But I say to you, do not swear at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by the earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. And do not swear by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. Let your word be yes, yes, or no, no. Anything more than this comes from the evil one." The Gospel of the Lord. I have decided that I am going to start reading through the text for a given Sunday before I pull together the preaching schedule here, so that when I get a text like this that takes on anger and adultery and divorce, I can say, "Pastor Tasha, have at it." I also want to give you fair warning that it is my practice to make eye contact with you during the sermon. If, however, I happen to be looking at you at some point in the sermon, it's not because I'm accusing you of being guilty for what we're talking about. It's just the practice of being engaged with the congregation. So we look at anger, we look at adultery, we look at divorce in this text. All of these teachings of Jesus are Jesus' interpretation of Scripture, and they give a guideline for how people are supposed to live in this alternative community that's guided by the kingdom of God. So as we live into this alternative community that lives out God's reign, we're going to take a look at anger. We're going to take a look at adultery. We're going to take a look at divorce. So the first example of an alternative community that lives out God's reign speaks about anger. In order to interpret what anger does, Jesus starts with the Ten Commandments. In particular, he refers to the commandment on murder, which comes to us in Exodus 20, verse 13. And what Jesus does is this. He connects murder and anger so that being angry with another, expressing that anger in the way of insulting others, using one's anger that leads to name-calling of others, or any public or violent language that is expressed out of anger is equivalent to the taking of a person's life. It raises for us this dilemma. We all get angry. It's a normal human reaction to be angry. It's a warning sign that something is going wrong. So how then are we to be able to acknowledge what's natural to us as humans, that we get angry, and at the same time hear Jesus' condemnation for being angry? And Jesus addresses this in a fascinating way. He asks the people who are the cause of the anger to be responsible for the well-being of those who are angry. But what Jesus says is that if you have someone has a beef against you, it's more important that you work that out before you gather at the altar. That you are responsible for the other person's anger. Being responsible for that anger, you then find ways to remove that anger so that person is not condemned for the anger. One of the ways that anger can be expressed is one-on-one relationships, but anger can be expressed in systemic ways as well. For example, anger can be expressed in the way that laws are enforced. A member of our congregation recently called my attention to the story of a young woman named Rosa Ortega, who lives in Texas. She's a permanent resident of the United States. Having permanent resident status, she is allowed to own property. She's allowed to serve in the military. She pays taxes, but she can't vote. She misunderstood the law about voting, and so in 2012 and in 2014, she voted, and she voted illegally because she misunderstood the law. As a result of that, she was arrested, and she was tried, and she was convicted with a sentence of 8 years in prison, and then deportation following that. She has four children who are United States citizens who will either have to be on their own when she's deported or will have to go back to Mexico with her. The inequity in this application of the law is that the standard sentence for violating this law in voting is usually 8 months probation. But the law was used to punish her because of her status in the United States. A member of our congregation made this observation about this case. What it will do is it will send a message to people of color: if you vote, you may go to jail. We must be concerned about times when the law is applied out of anger and we end up violating the integrity of another human being. First example then of living out this alternative community under God's reign is that we refrain from a public anger that uses the law to violate the integrity of others. The second example of living in an alternative community that lives out God's reign speaks of adultery. And once again, Jesus goes to the Ten Commandments, this time the commandment about adultery in verse 14 of Exodus 20. Now, I have to admit that every time I read this gospel text, I hear the line about lusting in your heart. I think of Jimmy Carter and how, unfortunately, he made a laughingstock of himself because he confessed that he had lusted in his heart. But Jesus takes this commandment and frames it in a fascinating way. To get at it, we ask, how do you look at another person? Do you look at that other person as a human being that is not to be violated? Or do you look at that person as an object to be consumed to satisfy your own desires? It's that second way of looking at people that Jesus speaks against. Because in looking at another person as an object that exists to satisfy our desires is like the lion looking for prey. Jesus speaks directly then to a predatory way of life. In particular, he speaks to men who are predators on women who are seen as nothing more than a product to be consumed. And what Jesus does is he defines a new paradigm for men and women to relate to one another. And this new paradigm is that women are more than objects to be consumed to satisfy one's desire. They are human beings that are not to be violated because of our desires. I think this new paradigm challenges us then to look at what we do with the human body, how we can make ourselves products to be consumed. Look at how we worry about how we look and how we appear because we want to be attractive to someone else. We see that expressed as well in the use of pornography, where those images on the screen or in the magazines are seen simply as objects to arouse one's desire. We see that done in gentlemen's clubs and strip clubs across our country as well, where women are objects simply for the entertainment of men. And even more so now, we see the existence of human trafficking. Young girls used to satisfy the desires of men. And yes, it happens even frequently in Pennsylvania Dutch territory of Lancaster County. We are to live by a new paradigm, a new way of looking at one another, where we don't violate the integrity of the other person by seeing them as nothing more than object. So the first example of living out God's reign reframes how we deal with our anger. The second example reframes how we live with the presence of others in our lives. The third example of an alternate community that lives out God's reign is how we speak of divorce. Now, unlike murder and adultery, which are addressed in the Ten Commandments, divorce is not addressed in the Ten Commandments. But there is mention of divorce in Deuteronomy 24, verses 1 through 4. And this mention of divorce in Deuteronomy neither justifies it nor does it forbid divorce. What Jesus teaches about divorce can also be found later in the Gospel of Matthew in the 19th chapter, verses 8 through 9. And what Jesus does is he starts by talking about what marriage is. Not critiquing it, but offering what marriage is. And Jesus describes it as that moment where two become one flesh. And that notion of two becoming one flesh is a countercultural notion because it leads to the conclusion of the equality and mutuality of male and female. There is no distinction when it comes to value and worth between man and women. After Jesus defines that new way of looking at one another, Jesus puts a limit on divorce, which only males could initiate in Jesus' day, and the limit on divorce is only in cases of unchastity. Now, the temptation at this point would be to say, so anyone who has had a spouse who has had an affair allows room for divorce, but I think Jesus is narrowing in on chastity to a more specific concern captured in Leviticus 18, which is that one is forbidden to have sexual relationships with members of one's own family. So Jesus significantly limits what males could initiate, the area of divorce. Jesus limits the male power over women. It is important then to equalize, not giving other options out of divorce. And that is why Jesus takes the risk of trapping people in loveless relationships by speaking only about one reason for divorce. It is important that men and women are seen as equal. Divorce is about a claim of power. The person who initiates the divorce is the one who is claiming power. In initiating divorce, the person is using the court system to claim power over the one that one is divorcing. But it also means that one is claiming power over one's children. One is claiming power over one's children's friends. Years ago, my son asked at the dinner table, "Dad, are you and Mom going to get divorced?" And we hadn't fought for 2 or 3 days. And I didn't think he still remembered that. And he goes, "No, because one of my friends at school, his parents are getting divorced, and I was afraid it was going to happen to you as well." And so it has power over our children's friends. It then has power over our children's friends' parents, who are required then to explain what is going on. It has power over our friends, our extended family. It has power over the church, because when couples who are both active in the church divorce, it is awkward to be together in the same building at the same time. It has impact on the workplace because the emotional demands that is required of it. Living in this alternate community then means that we live out God's reign. We take seriously how anger can be expressed by using the law to violate others. We take seriously looking at other people as objects to be consumed to satisfy our desires, and we take seriously the mutuality of men and women. Jesus tells us that there's only one way that we can live out that new reality. That is, if our righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees. Now, we assume that when Jesus talks about scribes and Pharisees, that he's talking about the really good religious people, and that creates a problem for us because we're supposed to even be better than the best religious person that we know. But instead, when Jesus raises up the scribes and Pharisees, he is pointing out that they have aligned themselves with the Roman Empire and its claims on human life. And in aligning themselves with the Roman Empire, they have aligned themselves with a way of governing where only a small group of elite people lead the nation. And they have aligned themselves with those who have control over the political, economic, and military structures and to use them for their own benefit. And so it's not about being better than the best religious folk. It's about aligning ourselves with a different way of doing kingdom, a way that comes from God shown to us in Jesus. Our excessive righteousness comes as we behold a God who is revealed to us in Jesus Christ. Now that does raise a question for us. What God are you looking at? What God are you looking at? And I think, unfortunately, church is guilty of looking at God who is one who is a critical spectator, the eternal threatener, always threatening to judge. And we must realize that we become what we behold. And if that is our vision of God, we too then will become the one who criticizes and judges. As those who become what they behold and criticize and judge, then we become preoccupied with exclusion. Who's deserving and who is not? Christianity and the church has built its temple on that kind of God. And I dare say that if the church continues to build on that vision of God, the church will die. Richard Rohr asks us, instead of seeing God as the eternal threatener, a perpetual critic, see God as the ultimate participant in human life. That God's love for each one of us is expressed in God being present and active in our lives. In becoming what we behold, then, we can see the life-giving power of God. And in seeing the life-giving power of God, we can live out our lives in the same way. God that we are called to look at, the God that will bring life to the faith community, the God who is merciful, forgiving us of our past, a God who is present in those deepest moments of pain, consoling us and giving us comfort. And a God who at the time of our greatest despair is offering the very gift of resurrection life. And when we look at others through the eyes of resurrection, we start living in a new kind of community, one based on the reign of God, where we don't use anger as a way to violate the integrity of others, where we see men and women in mutuality, and where we understand that other people do not exist merely for our pleasure, but exist to join with us in giving worship and praise to God.